It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Street vending's an ancient occupation worldwide. It has a hip persona here, but we're the exception. Today we meet a fifth-generation street vendor from Malaysia. She's an ethnic Mamak whose caste system dictated that career for her the day she was born.
Well, I despise my childhood. I did not want to be a fifth generation of street vendor. But the food that I grew up eating somehow brought me back to the person that I was. There was no Mamak style street food in San Francisco, and I decided to just dive in. And I somehow from there had embraced the culture that I so don't want to be in. And now all I want to do is just talk about Mamak food, Mamak people, and who we are.
Street vendor Azalina Yusope, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Azalina Yusope is a street vendor in San Francisco. She's a Malaysian Mamak by birth, which means she's a Tamil Muslim. And at birth, her future was sealed. If you're Mamak in Malaysia, you usually become a street vendor. She would be the fifth generation of vendors in her family. But Azalina fought desperately, she says, to escape her culture. She even became a Western pastry chef until she realized something she hadn't counted on. Our contributor Frances Lamb got to talk with Azalina about the curious ways that home can play out.
Azalina, it's so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So I think a lot of people look at food vendors and street carts and food trucks and all that as this trendy thing, or they see it as a very transient thing. You know, people come and it's like the one job they can get, and so they work at it for a few years until they can get out of it. But you come from older stuff than that. You come from a family that has been street vendors for four generations before you in Malaysia. What was it like growing up in a family like that?
Well, I despise my childhood. I did not want to be a fifth generation of street vendor. Just growing up in Malaysia, as much as it's a taboo, we do practice caste system where it says in your birth certificates what ethnicity you are and what community you come from. So you're limited to things that you can do even though you have high potential. You know, we grew up in a harsh environment that's it's just hardships and poverty, and you know, we get make fun of. There's a lot of slur being thrown on at us, and that's something that I didn't want, and trying to get away as much as possible from it. So I left Malaysia when I was 15 to pursue something else. I wanted to be a lawyer or doctor or teacher. Those are the high well-regard jobs in Malaysia at that time. But with no money and no experience and no contacts and no network, I ended up going to Singapore and did an apprentice for pastry. After that, I left Malaysia and travel and work in six different countries before I ended up in the United States. That is when things just went spiral down. As a person, I feel like I have lost the identity of myself because I was living in a very superficial personality. I was just trying to be something else, which I was not. So the food that I grew up eating somehow came back to me and brought me back to the person that I was. And that was about 3.5 years ago. Just looking around, there was no Mamak style street food in San Francisco, and I decided to just dive in and see what will happen from there, because the food that I grew up eating kind of make me feel as a whole, as a person, and a better understanding who I am. And I somehow from there had embraced the culture that I so don't want to be in. And now all I wanted to do is just talk about Mamak food, Mamak people, and who we are, and why I'm doing what I'm doing, and all these great four generations before me, all this fantastic thing that they have done that had impact on the food society in Malaysia, especially my dad. He's been such a tremendous impact in the food culture in Malaysia for what he was doing. That's exactly where I'm standing right now. I mean, I'm trying to kind of do the same thing that the four generations before me have done. And I feel like I'm doing it kind of on the right tracks. It's growing one step at a time.
It's so interesting that you talked about really wanting to leave this culture, and then when you did, feeling estranged from it and feeling like, oh, it was the food that could bring it back to you and maybe help you see it in a new way. Do you see where you came from differently now?
Absolutely. I see where I came from in a very different perspective right now. I decided just to sell food and to use food that I grew up eating and the culture I grew up eating as a channel. And hopefully it will give some light to Mamak people. You know, there's some of them that successfully gotten away rebelliously like me. But like people like my brother and my cousins, they're still there. They're stuck. They can't do much about it. They either work in a factory or they sweep or they sell food on the street. But I'm lucky enough that I'm here in San Francisco and doing what I'm doing. It's a mecca of food culture here. So that's what I'm trying to take. I'm not looking at the negativity. I'm looking at the positivity that I have grown up into. You know, our culture is so amazing. Our wedding still have 10,000 people in one room and celebrating and blessing everybody. And you cook for 7 days and you have marriage for 7 days. And just the food and the ingredients and how loud we talk to each other. People always think we're fighting, but we're not fighting. That's just the way we talk to each other. and then coming from a spice-rooted family, everybody come to us if they need advice of how using spices, how to harvest them, and so forth. So we're basically the advisor for food culture in Malaysia. And that's so amazing that I did not see it when I was growing up. All I see is just the poverty that we have.
Yeah. But here in the United States, it seems like you've really are making the most of the opportunity you have here. Can you tell me a little bit about your typical day? What's a typical day like for Azalina?
Well, I spend a lot of time in the kitchen. I get up at 2, I get to work by 3, and I start getting everything ready before my staff come at 7 o'clock. So by that time they come, I'm already cooking so many things that takes a really, really long time to make. By the time they come, I'm still there in the kitchen, and I'll do all my deliveries. I love to meet the buyers that have built partnership with us just to see how things are, and then in between, I'm dropping my children off at school, and I come back again, and if we have high-profile events, I'm taking care of that. I'm still sending emails in the meantime, and usually my day, I don't leave my kitchen until 10:30, 11 o'clock. And by the time I get home, that's when I'm checking emails, doing invoices, and that's a very typical day for me.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's so important that I still feel in love with what I do. It's just been 3.5 years. I didn't grow up making Mamak street food. It's just here, the last 3.5 years. Trying to figure out how to make this Malaysian food just almost the same as the way I have eaten them in Malaysia.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Azalina. It's been great to talk with you.
Nice talking to you, Francis.
Azalina Yusope is owner of Azalina's in San Francisco. Francis Lam is an editor-at-large at Clarkson Potter and a monthly Eat columnist for the New York Times Magazine. Azalina left us with her recipe for Malaysian open-faced nachos. Talk about a marriage of America and Malaysia. Well, you can find it at splendidtable.org. A new toolbox is evolving in mainstream health. It now holds eating for wellness, mindfulness, listening to your gut, yoga, meditation, affirmations, all in the name of self-healing. Well, one master of this mix is Louise Hay. She's been practicing and teaching self-healing for decades. With over 50 publications in print, Louise took a different turn with her latest book. She teamed with two cohorts to talk about food. The book is Loving Yourself to Great Health, Thoughts and Food, The Ultimate Diet. Louise Hay and her co-author, Heather Dane, join us. Welcome, you two. Good to have you with us.
We are delighted to be here.
Thank you, Lynn.
Well, Louise, big statement in this book, The Ultimate Diet. Now, from what you three lay out, the diet is really just a part of an entire process.
Well, isn't everything in life a part of a process? You know, and choosing your food that really supports you and helps your health, that's part of a very good process.
One of the things you, of course, have become very known for, and you talk about in the book, is learning to love yourself.
Oh, good heavens, that's the most important thing in the world.
How did you come to this, though? Because this is not something that's easy or you just, you know, turn over one day and say, oh, I love myself, and all else will follow.
You know, it was living life and learning experiences and, you know, becoming aware that the thoughts you think and the words you speak really have an enormous amount to do with how you live your life. If you think worry thoughts all your life, you will be worried and miserable. It's not a joyous person. You can't be a joyous person. But when you become aware of the process, then you can start to guide the process.
Mm-hmm. Heather, how did you come to this? What was your path?
Well, I actually had depression, and I also had very bad digestive issues growing up from the time I was, at least from the time I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. I never really felt well after I ate. And it was probably a good thing that I didn't feel well, because that's what got me on the path to looking for better answers. I studied Louise's work, and I studied and researched the science behind digestive health and mm-hmm. emotional health. And I wanted my food to taste good.
Yeah.
So I started to learn how to cook and to pick better ingredients. And what I came to realize is that when you make food a sensory experience and you bring your body back into it, it makes a huge difference. And to experience the joy of food has a connection to your mind. And we know this from science. Science now tells us that when you eat, you're feeding a team of bacteria in your body. And if you feed them well, the bacteria in your body stay in harmony. And there's a 24/7 connection from your digestive system to your brain. So there's a really good reason to pick better ingredients.
I think it's difficult for us to make that connection between the things that will really give us a sense of inner happiness, contentment, well-being, and what we eat. It's sometimes a hard struggle. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, sometimes when you hear something brand new, you go, oh, rubbish, that's nonsense. And you don't even give it a chance. But other times you hear something brand new and you think, oh, is that possible? Mm-hmm. And you will explore. So it depends on how you approach it. But I've always said that resistance is the first step towards learning.
Mm-hmm.
You could say the affirmation, you know, this is something I can do. It's easy if I take it step by step. Let's see what the first step is.
Uh-huh.
Now, I will say that in my own evolution of changing my diet, taste buds do change. And as your digestive system heals, your taste buds start asking for the foods that you need. So I would say to really connect to your body. And as you eat, notice how the food is affecting you, even if you're making no changes in your diet to begin with. And we forget this process. It used to be back in the way back with our ancestors when they were tribal people. They didn't know what food was safe to eat, so they would taste it. And they would have this experience of knowing what foods worked for them. And we've kind of lost this process because food isn't dangerous for us anymore. So we just eat what is there or what's easy for us.
Right.
But if we go back to feeling into the body and really listening to the body, we can find out, did this feel good in my body? Do I feel satisfied? A couple of hours later, do I still have energy? Do I have any symptoms? Am I having a headache? Do I feel shaky? Mm-hmm. Am I calm or am I feeling a little nervous? Looking for symptoms, both emotional and physical, and even writing them down. You know, one of the things we talk about is doing a food diary and just writing down for an entire week or two what you ate and then how you feel.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned your names to two of my friends and their eyes lit up, first of all. You know, it was, really? You're going to talk to them? This is fabulous. And the next words that came out of their mouths in unison was bone broth.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now,
yes.
Tell me about bone broth.
Well, bone broth is wonderful because it heals and seals the digestive system. Basically, what it is you take some bones. After, let's say you've just finished a chicken. Right. And now you've got the carcass left of the chicken. And most people will just throw that in the garbage. But instead of doing that, you can now put it into a stock pot or a crock pot, cover it up with water. And if you have ends of vegetables, skins of onions, eggshells, things like that that you've been saving, you can throw that in. You add a little apple cider vinegar.
Bring out the calcium.
Exactly.
Oh, is that what the apple cider vinegar does?
It pulls all the minerals out of the bones, exactly. And, you know, what I love what Louise does is if you go into her freezer, you open the door, and inside one of the bins, she has a bag, and she throws all her scraps throughout the week. So all the things we used to throw away, the ends of carrots, you know, all the different pieces.
Onion peels, everything.
Yeah. And when she's ready to make bone broth, she just takes the bones and takes all the scraps of vegetables and puts it into the stock pot, covers it with water, adds the apple cider vinegar, brings it to a boil.
And then bring it very low, and I cook it for at least 24 hours. And the longer you cook it, the better you are getting all the minerals out of the bones and the vegetables. And then when that is strained, you have fantastic broth to work with. And right. I also have this thing of if I cook a vegetable in the broth, I might take the vegetable out, eat it, but keep the broth. And the next time I cook another vegetable, I put that vegetable in the broth.
And it makes the bone broth better.
Yes. Absolutely. You're constantly nourishing yourself. I love you, darling. Here, have this to eat.
Heather, Louise, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, we've had so much fun.
Thank you, Lynn.
It's been fun for me, too. Thank you.
All right.
Louise Hay and Heather Dane with Alea Cadreau are authors of Loving Yourself to Great Health. And they left us with that recipe for bone broth. It's at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the flip-flop of modern food journalism and the essentials of roasting from the obsessive Michael Ruhlman. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In case you haven't noticed, food news is no longer relegated to the local food section of your newspaper. It's everywhere, from CNN to Fox to the Huffington Post and the New Yorker. Our appetite appears to be insatiable. So why are we so interested, and who are these people who are writing about food? Our contributor, Melissa Clark, a food writer herself at the New York Times, is turning to journalist Kat Kinsman for some answers. Kat's CV includes former managing editor of CNN's Eatocracy and now editor-in-chief of Tasting Table.
Hi, Kat. So happy to have you here.
I am delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Kat, tell us, why has food become so important to people in the media? What are they looking for?
It's the only subject that you can cover that absolutely every single person has something to do with. Everybody eats. Not everybody is fetishy about it, and that's okay. I do a little game with myself if I'm traveling, and I try to talk to three different people who I've never met before, and the inroad is always food. Somebody's eaten today. Somebody's thinking about where they're going to eat. Everybody has a stake in the game.
But I've noticed that over the past decade or so, food has become even more important. I mean, there were always food sections, there are always food magazines, but lately there's just been this sort of snowballing effect. Everybody wants to read about food. Why do you think it's become so important?
Well, it is a new entertainment. Not everybody feels that they can keep up with music or politics or any of these things. This is a thing that you can achieve in the comfort of your own home. You can show a little bit of who you are through what you serve. It is inherently a generous act. You know, everybody's got a point of view. Everybody is correct. And that's, you can't argue with somebody's likes. Everybody eats and everybody has a point of view.
Do you think that because there are more people blogging about what they're eating every day, that it makes it more accessible, that people feel like they can join the conversation more easily?
In some ways, I feel like social media can make all of this a little bit off-putting. I talk about sort of this Pinterest phobia that, you know,
Do you have one?
I don't pay a huge amount of attention to Pinterest because I realize the reality versus the perception there. There was a survey done recently. One of the morning shows did it about Pinterest anxiety that mothers have in particular, and it really they feel physical anxiety from seeing the other things that other mothers that other people out there are achieving in their own kitchens, whether it's classroom cupcakes, some sort of dinner that they have made. And they back off from trying this at home, and that actually really makes me sad. So I think if you can eliminate some of the visual elements of social media and have just people talk about food, it whets the appetite. It inspires, it includes, and I think that's a very positive thing.
So how important are the recipes? I mean, I think across the web, recipes are the way that people are. It's the entry point into a lot of different websites, into different blogs, and I know at the Times, it's the way that we're developing our audience. We are putting recipes out there to try to get people who are interested in cooking at home aside from all of our other food coverage. And how do you find that works for you?
Recipes have to be bulletproof. Absolutely. They have to work. And, this is my first test kitchen, and I'm so thrilled. I was at AOL before I was at CNN. And in both places, we relied on chef recipes, cook's recipes. And we would, I love vintage cookbooks deeply, passionately. And we would test things out in our own kitchens. But that's not the same as having a team who is in there trying these recipes out and making sure that they absolutely work. They 100% have to. If you see something on Tasting Table, it has been tested and retested. And there is trust built up there. And that's why I really do argue in favor of the bloggers who meticulously test things, who develop recipes on their own, who it's not they change one ingredient from an established recipe and call it theirs. I believe in intellectual property being intensely important and originality. When I cook from things I find on the web, I go to established sources, either bloggers I trust or places that I know test over and over.
Well, the idea that people are taking other people's recipes, I mean, you see that a lot. That's something that comes up, the ethics of blogging. So do you think that there's a difference in the ethics between food bloggers and food journalists?
In my ideal world, no. But I think there are different kinds of bloggers, and I think you just really have to pick a lane about what sort you're going to be. There are bloggers who I trust absolutely and implicitly because they are staking their own reputation on what they put out there online. They are going to fact check themselves. They are going to keep themselves honest. They will disclose if there has been any sort of influence or freebies on it. And that said, there's a different kind of food blogger too. Ones who really are heavily influenced by products and trips and freebies. And I think that they can be just as valid so long as they fully disclose where any of that comes from. I need to feel a level of trust. And I always say it's sort of like porn, you know, when you see it. And and I think if people want to have an ongoing relationship with their readers, there needs to be a trust level there. A lot of bloggers are actually signing pledges and petitions. The Association of Food Journalists has an ethics policy there, and I think they're encouraging more bloggers to do that. And I think some of that is just a matter of education because there's absolutely no barrier to entry to becoming a blogger. And I think some just don't know, like, hey, wait, I wasn't supposed to do that, or if I did take that, I need to mention that because it's not something that comes about in your everyday life. Unless somebody tells you, you might actually not know that.
So who are the food bloggers and the food writers that you really love to read?
Well, food writers, Francis Lamb, I will read. He could write absolutely anything. He could write a Gowanus Canal water report. And I would and I would read that just because. And he's somebody who has gone to various outlets, and his prose is perfect no matter where you go, and it's playful. Michael Procopio from Food for the Thoughtless has these really idiosyncratic, fantastic stories to share. And then, it's a bit of profanity, S... food blogger.
Ooh.
Is my favorite person on Twitter who really skewers kind of the food blogging community and is a treat each and every day.
Kat, it was so great talking to you. Thank you for coming.
This was such a treat for me. Thanks for having me.
Kat Kinsman is editor-in-chief of Tasting Table. Melissa Clark is a food columnist at the New York Times. Well, try one of Kat's favorite recipes from Tasting Table. It's caramelized onion dip with feta, spinach, and walnuts. And it's you know where, splendidtable.org. ¶¶ people talk about essential cooking techniques, at the top of the heap is roasting. It's an instinctual act. Long ago, we roasted over live fire. Now, most of us have evolved to the less tricky heat of the oven. You turn it on, pop in the roast, and go. Well, not so fast. There are a few things to understand about the act of roasting. WNYC's Leonard Lopate turned to the technique-obsessed Michael Ruhlman, author of Ruhlman's How to Roast, Foolproof Techniques, and Recipes for the Home Cook.
Welcome back, Michael.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Isn't roasting a kind of primordial thing?
It is. It originally meant over flame. And it wasn't until the invention of the oven that roast and bake became the same thing.
So roasting and baking are the same thing? Or is it a difference of a matter of temperature, time?
No, it's semantic. Basically, I divide it into baking is anything with flour or eggs. Roasting is just about anything else, usually protein or vegetables.
We wouldn't say we had a baked chicken.
No, and you wouldn't say I had a roasted cake.
But in the end, it's the same. One of the problems I've had with roasting and baking is not all ovens are the same.
That's a very good point. And while I was working on the Bouchon Bakery cookbook with Thomas Keller and his executive chef of Bouchon Bakery, Sebastian, one of the things Sebastian always said was, know your oven. All ovens are different. They behave differently. You need to pay attention to how your own oven behaves.
How do you go about evaluating an oven?
By using it. And you can actually test your oven by buying some Pillsbury biscuits and putting them on sheet trays and baking them for exactly the right time that the instructions say. Those recipes have been heavily tested. And you can see if they're underdone, your temperature's a little low. Or if it's overdone, your temperature's a little high. That's a way to test your oven.
Aren't there also hot spots within ovens?
That's where you find the hot spots. So you put the biscuits throughout the sheet pan and you see where the hot spots are.
Some of them wind up being a lot darker than the other, and
exactly.
You don't know why they're all in the same pan.
Exactly.
So isn't that taken care of by simply rotating the pan?
And that's why many recipes instruct you to do just that, to avoid the hot spot issue. And if you have a convection oven, which blows the air around in there, you have less problem with that.
So do you like convection ovens?
I do like convection ovens, especially for roasting. Like roasting a chicken, part of the thing that you want to do is you want to dehydrate the skin so it becomes crispy. And in order to do that, you need the steam that is lifting off the chicken as it roasts to be pushed away so that's the hot air, and so you get a really crisp chicken skin. So I do like convection.
You say that pan roasting is a practice common in restaurants, but that more people should do it at home.
Yes.
What kind of pan do you prefer?
Certainly one without a plastic handle. you can't do it. You need it. You every kitchen should have stainless steel or cast iron pans that they can put in the oven. So I usually use a cast iron pan for pan roasting.
Mm-hmm. And is there a problem with sticking?
Not if you do it right. The sticking issue, which people worry about, is a matter of getting your pan hot enough before you put the meat in. And then, importantly, not moving that meat around because you're afraid it's going to stick. It needs to caramelize on the bottom, and then itself will release from the bottom of the pan.
You got in trouble when you did a blog about roast chicken with the headline, America Too Stupid to Cook. What were you trying to say there?
I was trying to say that we're taught that cooking is hard, that we're too stupid to cook. And we're taught this by food preparers and food processors who want us to buy their pre-cooked food. We'll make your life easier and less stressful. Well, we've been doing this for years, and are our lives easier, less stressful? No, they're more stressful. We're less healthy.
Is it that hard to roast a chicken?
No. You salt it. You put something in the cavity or tie its legs together, and you put it in a 450, 425-degree oven for an hour, and that's it. And about the cavity, it's important that somebody either you trust the bird or you stick an onion or a lemon in there, because the hot air that circulates within the cavity overcooks the breasts, and that's why breasts are so often overcooked when we roast a chicken. And then I like that the skin sticks to the bottom of the pan when I pull the chicken off, because it gives me a good fond to make a wine and water pan sauce with some onion and carrot while the bird rests. It's very important to let the bird rest at least 15 minutes. It'll stay hot inside for 30 minutes. Don't worry about it cooling down. The bird actually finishes cooking outside the oven. The juices redistribute. The heat evens out throughout the chicken, and it makes it a finished perfect bird.
Now, many people insist that you baste the bird as it is roasting.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I baste it, but if I'm not around and I'm doing something else, I don't. But I like to baste it because that hot fat delivers heat to the skin and helps get that really crispy crust. And if you add some thyme to that fat and garlic to that fat and then baste the chicken, it will add more flavor to it.
There's always a matter of when it's done. Should you use a meat thermometer? Should you just cut along the leg?
No. What you should do is pull the pan out of the oven and using a flat-edged wooden spoon or some sort of implement, tilt the chicken so that the juices run out. And if they're really bloody, it's not done. When they're clear, it's completely done.
You also have a number of recipes for roasting vegetables. Brussels sprouts, you think that's the best way to eat Brussels sprouts?
My children will not eat boiled Brussels sprouts, but if you roast Brussels sprouts in bacon fat, I guarantee your kids will eat the Brussels sprouts.
You use a low-sided pan.
Yes, because that keeps the air circulating around, and you want the vegetables to brown, and it won't brown if there's too much moisture.
And if you're doing roasted root vegetables, you say that adding a sprinkling of red wine vinegar is important. Is there a chemical reaction?
No, it's because they often tend to be so sweet when they're roasted, and that's to season them to offset the sweetness, especially if you're using beets, which is a great vegetable to roast with roasted vegetables.
If you're doing the other vegetables, do you put the salt on before you start roasting, or do you wait until you think that they're pretty much done?
I salt before they go into the oven. I salt everything before I start cooking it.
Michael Ruhlman, thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Michael Ruhlman is the author of How to Roast, Foolproof Techniques and Recipes for the Home Cook. Leonard Lopate is host of WNYC's The Leonard Lopate Show, where you can find more great food segments and recipes at WNYC.org. Be sure to check out the recipe Michael left for us for roasted pineapple with vanilla ice cream and caramel sauce. It's at splendidtable.org. We'll be back in a minute with What Exactly is a Japanese Knife? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're connecting with you. Get to us at 800-537-5252. And remember, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. We have got Christopher on the line from Austin, Texas. Hey, Christopher, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I'm a university student here in Austin, and I've been practicing more in the kitchen, but I'm trying to beef up my skills. And so I'd like to know more about, you know, maybe some marinades that I can make or something just to incorporate more flavors into the kitchen. And we come from a Mexican family, so I know quite a few Mexican dishes, and I love to get into those flavors. But like I said, I'm trying to learn something new that isn't too challenging, but that you know, builds on what I know.
Well, let's think for a minute. You know, let me ask you something. You're in Austin, and do you have access to Asian ingredients? Because I'm thinking, with the Mexican background, believe it or not, I see a link between that and Asia, in the sense that there are seasonings that are used with the same kind of balance of flavors, you know, of the tart, the, when I say sweet, I don't mean sugar sweet, but anyway, do you like Asian food? And do you have access to Asian ingredients that aren't going to break the bank?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because I actually studied abroad in Japan last summer for a couple months. And I developed quite a taste for Asian food. And luckily enough, to answer your question, we have very good access to those kinds of markets here in Austin.
Okay. So here's the thing. Let's talk authors, all right? Because these people write really good recipes. One of them is Mai Pham, M-A-I, and then P-H-A-M. Mm-hmm. And she did a book on Thai and Vietnamese cooking. It's a paperback book. It came out quite a while ago. You'll find a couple of her recipes on our website. Her stuff is really simple and utterly delicious. And what I would do is I would start with just learning how to make the dipping sauce that's used as a dressing, and you can use it as a marinade because it's a really great basic. You take, let's say for argument's sake, a couple of tablespoons of fish sauce, a couple of tablespoons of water, a couple of tablespoons of lime or lemon juice, and a bit of sugar to taste and a little hot pepper. Okay, so right there, you've got this really kind of interesting mix. And you pour that over anything, a piece of fish, you marinate vegetables in it, whatever, it is going to taste fabulous. Or if you want to just do rice noodles, pour that sauce over them, chop up whatever vegetables you've got raw, all right? A bit of fruit for sweetness and balance, and then add to that, if you want, any leftover meat you want, some tofu or no protein at all. And that can be a fabulous supper.
And let me ask you, what kind of fruit would you recommend for that?
Well, you know, it would be fabulous in something like that. At this time of year, mango, papaya, but you could use peaches, you could use cherries, you could use nectarines, you could use apples, you could use pear.
Really?
Yeah.
I know Thai food uses quite a bit of cinnamon at times as well.
That's right.
Would there be a place for any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is where we get into maybe making a basic curry, okay? This is the basic idea. Equal parts of ginger and garlic, a lot of onion, and chili to taste. And you can use any chili you like. So you can mix the Mexican background with all those rich, flavorful chilies into this. And then cinnamon in there as well to taste.
Okay.
Okay, and if you want some cloves, you slow cook it in a saucepan, in a decent-sized saucepan, with a little bit of oil, or if you want, coconut fat, okay? And you let that cook until it's really aromatic. That is your curry base. Now, that can go in the fridge, and you take 5 or 6 tablespoons of that, heat it up in a saucepan, throw in some tomato, throw in a can of coconut milk, throw in some chopped up meat and let it cook, or throw in a mess of vegetables, things like ikama and cabbages and all kinds of things, you know, like broccoli and cauliflower and even some tart greens, and it'll taste fabulous. So that's the basic idea.
Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Really, just read those recipes before you do anything. That's
okay.
One of the great keys is know what you're doing. Pull out all the ingredients, and you're off and running.
Well, I made one of the recipes about a chicken that you mentioned a while ago with an adobo sauce.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
So much fun because I was getting home from work, and I said, man, I want to make something kind of knockout tonight. And I just had so much fun doing it. And I thought, why don't I call her and ask her for something to try?
You know, that adobo sauce is great with fish. It's great with any kind of meat you like. And it's fabulous with vegetables.
Yeah, I bought a mojarrita from the store, and I was in the kitchen grinding it up, and I had so much fun. So
This is fabulous. This is fabulous. Okay, Christopher, enjoy. And thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. And Gary is on the phone from Coolidge, Arizona. Gary, where's Coolidge?
Coolidge is about halfway between Phoenix and Tucson.
Okay. All right. And so what do you want to talk about?
Tangerines. I've got 2 tangerine trees in my backyard, and when they get ripe, they're all ripe at the same time, and they don't last on the tree, so we have to pick all of them at once and end up with 5 or 6 bushels of tangerines.
Oh, my Lord.
We tend to juice a lot of them and freeze the juice, but my wife and I are trying to come up with other ideas for using tangerines.
I'm just thinking, you know, one of the things I love are the rinds of the tangerines. They're used in certain areas of China. And I used to, when I would get tangerines, I would dry the rinds on the radiator. when we were living in an old apartment building. And I still occasionally just save those rinds and I throw them into everything. You know, I mean, anything at all, meat, vegetables or whatever. You cook green beans with tangerine rinds and some salt and pepper and garlic. Not a bad thing. But you want to know what to do with the fruit inside the rind.
Yes,
One thing that occurs to me, and I had fair success with this, was taking, now this was with seeded tangerines, just putting them in a bag and freezing them, and then adding a bit of lime juice to them and throwing them in a food processor, and essentially making a sorbet. And if they needed a little sugar or honey or agave, I'd add it as I was pureeing it.
Yeah, we've actually done that, and our grandkids love to eat them just frozen.
Oh, yeah, they're fabulous, just frozen. But if you want to get elegant, you can make them into, in quotes, an ice cream. And if you add a little cream at the very end of that pureeing, it's not a bad idea either, or a little mascarpone. But, you know, another thing is all the savory stuff you can do with tangerines. Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm thinking, especially you're in Arizona, and I'm in my chili period here, but I'm thinking of kind of a salsa that you could have in the fridge or you could freeze, which would be essentially, I would saute garlic and a lot of ginger. And throw in whatever chili you like, and then add the tangerine to that, and simmer that, and let, you know, and do whatever seasoning, salt, pepper, etc. And that becomes like a combination of a jam slash cooked salsa.
Oh, that sounds good too.
And also you could do it in a savory way where you season it with black pepper and the chilies.
Yeah.
And a you know, fair amount of garlic.
Yeah, being in the Southwest, we're big on chilies.
Too. Yeah, yeah, and you've got wonderful chilies there.
Yes.
And, you know, you could finish it off with fresh cilantro, but that can become a condiment that you serve with almost anything.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really good.
Yeah, and then the other thing is, if you've got them all frozen, drop them into anything. I mean, I'm just thinking you're doing a tomato soup. You know, orange and tomatoes, fabulous. There's no reason why tomato and tangerine can't be fabulous, too.
That sounds good.
Yeah. And in fact, fresh tomato, oil and vinegar, and those tangerines tossed with hot rice.
Oh.
Yeah.
Might have to try that tonight.
Yeah. So I think we can find a lot of uses for those tangerines.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So. Yeah, I think so. And you can always put them in brandy.
Or cognac. That is
and rum.
Very good idea.
Yeah, and that way you don't have to crowd up that freezer.
Yeah.
You just get jars and you put a vanilla bean in there, maybe a teeny bit of sugar. You drop them in, you cover them with a nice dark rum. That's good. That's good stuff. That's very good stuff.
That sounds really good.
And we're very jealous you've got tangerine trees.
Well, I've also got blood orange, lemon, and grapefruit. We're really lucky that the citrus grows extremely well here.
You sure are. But enjoy the tangerines.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Gary. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
800-537-5252. Connect with us that way. Go to Facebook and Twitter, or you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Japanese knives are revered in the culinary world. They're the equivalent of a good sports car, and while a bit cheaper than a Porsche, they are not cheap. It makes sense that pros would make the investment, but what about those of us who simply love to cook? Worth it? Well, it's a complicated subject, so managing producer Sally Swift turned to a man who loves to take on complicated culinary subjects, David Rosengarten of the Rosengarten Report.
Hey, David, nice to have you back.
Hi, Sally. Good to be here.
So I want to talk about Japanese knives today. What actually makes a knife Japanese?
You know, that once upon a time, that was a very easy question. And the answer was, if it was made in Japan. Because, you know, 200 years ago, there were only three types of knives that were made in Japan. And each one had its own role in the kitchen. The classic Japanese prescription was one knife, one job. generally speaking, these knives, always then and now, are more lightweight than Western knives, mm-hmm. usually a thinner edge, better sharpening, holding that sharpness and that edge better. And in cutting food, you typically in Japanese knives didn't have as much crushing of the food as you might have mm-hmm. with a heavier Western knife. And if you crush the food, you're going to oxidize it and you're going to end up with different textures and flavors. So it was very easy. You know, 1840, what's a Japanese knife? One of the three classic types made in Japan. That was it. Mm-hmm. But then the world changed with the arrival of, among others, Americans. American warships showed up in Yokohama in 1853, and as you know, Japan was opened. Before that time, the Japanese only ate fish and vegetables, and these three knives were tailored for just fish and vegetable jobs. There were religious reasons why they didn't eat meat. But when those warlike Americans in the warships got there, they observed that Americans were eating meat. And it started to grow in interest and popularity. And then we reached this incredible moment in 1872 when the Emperor of Japan ate meat in public.
Oh, no.
And started to advocate the eating of meat. He said, as a nation, we need to get bigger and healthier and stronger. And they started to eat meat at that time. And what happened was the knives changed because the three classic types from before, they were never meant to cut meat. One of the changes that's involved is a Japanese knife traditionally, and still today, traditional ones, they have what's called a single bevel, mm-hmm. but the single bevel knife doesn't cut meat as well. So they developed a double bevel, a bevel on each side. So that's one way in which Japanese knives changed. And then also, in the 20th century, Western chefs all over the place started to notice these Japanese knives, and the Japanese artisans started to make knives for the Western kitchen. And this is about the time in the 1920s when the runaway, successful international Japanese knife was formed, and that was the Santoku. I'd say most people who have a Japanese knife today in their kitchens in America, restaurant or home, they have a Santoku, which was developed to do the things that all three of the former knives did, plus meat. It means something like three together or everything together, but that's what a Santoku is.
So what should you look for when you're buying one?
It's good to start thinking about the task. My favorite traditional Japanese knife, because I bought one, it's called a Yanagi. And you know when you go to the sushi bar and you're sitting there and the guy is beautifully slicing your sashimi with a long knife?
Yep.
That's a Yanagi. It's got the bevel on one side. Now, the problem with the bevel on one side is, did you ever cut something with a knife, like you're cutting an onion, and you find that the knife starts to go in its own direction?
Yes.
Like it's not that easy to control?
Yes.
That is much more likely to happen with a single bevel. However, a single bevel can get a much sharper hone on it. So that's why single bevel is good. Anyway, the Yanagi, the long sushi bar knife, always has a single bevel. And when you watch those beautifully trained sushi chefs behind the bar, let's say he's got a big slab of yellowtail. And what he does is he takes the heel of that long knife, the part that's near the handle, and he puts it up towards the top edge of the fish, and then he draws it through once. Does not saw back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes off is this glossy, super smooth surface that certainly changes the texture of your slice of sashimi, but many people claim that it even changes the flavor of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not as fishy, not as much oil released.
So there's a precision with the blade, essentially.
Exactly. And if somebody has occasion to slice raw fish or other things, I use my Yanagi to slice meat. If you can do that, you know, they're quite expensive, but that to me is the number one Japanese knife. Two other classic types are the Diba knife, which is a knife that is designed for boning fish, cutting their heads off, getting around the hard stuff that's, you know, at the gill and the tail. And then the other classic knife is the Usuba, which kind of looks like a cleaver. It's got a rectangular kind of look.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much the lineup, and people all over the place are making hundreds of variations on these basic types of Japanese knives.
I bet.
And it's no longer the case that a Japanese knife comes from Japan. There's a guy in Oregon who's making beautiful Japanese knives. In Germany, Wusthof is making Japanese knives. And, you know, if you buy a good one, you're certainly going to get one that is thinner and sharper than other knives. They keep their edge pretty well. And, you know, you sharpen a Japanese knife on a whetstone, and that's a whole thing in itself. There are plenty of whetstone sharpening moments on YouTube and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you don't have to – you know how a French chef, he's in the kitchen, right? He's got the sharpening steel and he's got the chef's knife. And usually before most tasks, it's like doing the sharpening before cutting, like maybe several times a day. You don't have to do that with a Japanese knife. So that's one thing that's nice about it.
Wow, David, that's a lot to know. Thanks for straightening us out.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sally.
David Rosengarten is the man behind the Rosengarten Report. Well, that's the show for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Chef Morimoto, who said, "Japanese chefs believe our soul goes into our knives once we start using them. You wouldn't put your soul in a dishwasher." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Head to splendidtable.org to find information on anything you heard here this week. Get registered for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Subscribe to our weekly podcasts. And while you're on the site, check out this month's giveaway. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhart. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.